Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, taking a look at the wonderful world of insects here in our state and maybe beyond with our guest, Phil Pelletieri, back with us. Phil is an entomologist and has been on the show forever. He's a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, comes by every few months to talk about bugs. And I hope you'll join in with your questions. What questions do you have for Phil? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Phil Pelletieri, good to have you back.
Thanks. Nice to be back.
Yeah, great to have you with us. So what effect does this weather have on insects that are emerging right now? We've had quite a bit of fluctuation this spring.
Yeah, not a lot. I mean, just like the plants, things were kind of behind schedule.
Yeah.
You know, I've always said when people were asking me to predict what the winter did to insects, I said the winter doesn't have any effect as much as the spring. And what gets insects in trouble is if you warm it up real early and then get real cold. And we didn't have that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as I've kind of watched things, things are getting close to being on schedule, still maybe just a little bit behind. That was that big heat push, you know, kind of got us a little closer to things. And what I've noticed just in my local neighborhood and has been disappointed is the lack of bees. Yeah. You know, a lot of neighbors are going to the no-mo May, and I'm just not seeing any critters out there in their dandelions and in their violets. And the one I caught yesterday, if you've got an azalea, I will warn you, there are little green worms that like to eat the leaves, and they are so well camouflaged, you don't see them at first, and be darned, every one of my azalea bushes was heavily infested, and they just started to push leaves. So this is the time to stop them if you have to. And so, and that's kind of the thing. You know, we're at the point now, there's a whole lot of insects that will cause defoliation that are just waking up and just starting now. So it's well worth going out, look at your plants closely, and if they seem to be overwhelmed with some critter, then you might have to intervene.
You know, I thought, because we've been talking about it on the show, I thought, you know what, I'm going to try the No Mow May this year just so I've got something, you know, to talk about how it's affected my lawn. As I look at my lawn, it's mostly violets and creeping Charlie, and it's all in bloom, and some dandelions. But I'm kind of I'm not seeing insects.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a whole lot of spring, what we would call spring bees. They're not honeybees. They're not bumblebees. And those are the ones I'm not seeing. And the same thing if I walk by a flowering crab or whatnot, where you normally see some activity. Yeah. And so, you know, it might just be localized. But we've always been concerned, aside from providing the flowers, there has to be diverse habitats. Now, some of the ground nesting bees, I've seen some activity, these spring ground nesting bees. I don't see any honeybees, but that's dependent if there's any neighbors that are keeping bees, and there have been in the past, but I don't think so, because as I said, I haven't seen a honeybee in my backyard in the last 3 weeks. So we'll wait and see. But as I said, this part of it, I think I don't want people to get too discouraged, because no mow is going the right direction, but it is a more complicated story than just that.
Yeah. Valerie in Oshkosh has a question for you. So let's go there. Hi, Valerie.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, my daughter has had stink bugs in her house all year round. And how do you get rid of them? I've lit candles hoping they'd fly in there. Mm-hmm. And she has cats and dogs. So,
sure. Well,
I've read something about peppermint oil keeps bugs out or spiders. But meanwhile, they're already in the house.
So everything that she's been seeing for the last 5 months came in last fall, and that's really where you have to draw the line. And what's different is this stink bug is an Asian species that has only been in the state for about 8 or 9 years now. And its claim to fame, like box elder bugs and whatnot, is they invade structures in the fall. And so the first thing that you try to look for, is there anything that I can seal up? You check all your roof vents, you check any place that there is gaps in the siding. And if you solve the riddle how they get in, they never get in and you're fine. Once they get in the walls or attic, to be honest, there is no magic. There's no way you can get to them. And so when it warms up enough for them to be active, that's when they kind of spill into your living space. The good news is they're moving out now. I mean, it really can't go on for more than a couple weeks, I would not expect. But as I said, the general direction is you draw the line in September, and either you build them out, or if that's impossible, if you are going to use treatments, you treat the outside of the house to stop them from getting in. And again, you're worrying about overhangs and other structural areas that they can squeeze in is really the biggest concern.
All right.
Okay. Yep. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, the number 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Alicia, in Duluth emailed that a while back she had a cute little green worm appear from her lettuce she was cleaning. She put it with some of the lettuce in a jar and noticed it was gone the next morning, but then she saw it had built a cocoon. She still has it in her kitchen, and she's wondering where should she put it so it can complete the metamorphosis.
Well, it will develop in the kitchen. It's just the question, if you catch it when it comes out, it's probably going to try to, if it's in a container, it might beat itself around quite a bit. So, I mean, one of the things you can do is just leave the container in the garage or out in the porch, let it emerge without the top on and get away. But it would be fun just to kind of see. As long as you check it every day, it might not be much of a problem. How fast it develops is temperature related. Insects go like you bake a cake because they're cold-blooded creatures. So at room temperature, you'd expect the transformation normally to take about 3 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks. If things are unusually cold, that slows down, but it should happen pretty quick. Sometimes you don't appear to see it emerge because it's had parasites or other problems, and that stops the proper development. Usually, I've got a young person that lives just down the street, and I gave him black swallowtail chrysalises and kept them more than winter in the garage, gave it to them, and we're waning. And I'm going to give it about another 10 days. If they don't come out, then I said, we got to bring these under the microscope and see if we can figure out why they didn't develop properly. But it's still in that time frame. As I said, warm temperatures, 2 to 3 weeks, we should have an adult.
Well, I'm wondering where she got the lettuce. I mean, was it lettuce from the store, possibly, or was it from a farmer's market?
That would make more sense. And we're in that point in Wisconsin that things aren't that far advanced, whereas if you got stuff that was imported from a warmer climate, then you'd expect the larvae to be fully developed. And, that's one of the things in the diagnostic lab. It was quite common to see critters that people brought from the grocery store, and including my favorite black widow spiders and grapes, but we won't go there. it happens, and it there's no health risks with those kind of things other than black widow, and so you can just pick them off, and I'm impressed that she allowed it to develop. Most people wouldn't let it do it that.
that's pretty cool. I like that a lot. Thanks, Alicia. For calling or for emailing, appreciate it. Why don't you email me back and tell me where that lettuce came from? I would just like to know that. So if you're still, I'm sure she's still listening, do that. Nancy in Platteville, we'll go to you. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I had Japanese beetles come to my linden trees last year, stripped one of the trees almost bare. I didn't understand what was happening. I kept finding those lacy leaf debris. And now this year I have bought a sprayer, neem oil, and an insecticidal grub control that you spread on the lawn. What else or what different should I do?
Sure. Okay, a couple things. Linden trees are Japanese beetle magnets. If we want to know if they're in the area, you drive around and look at the tops of the linden trees in July, because if they're there, that's the first thing they'll feed on. It would be very appropriate to spray the neem oil. And again, I would shoot for somewhere around the last week of June to the first week of July, depending on how the rest of the spring goes, is when you want to protect it. But the one frustration you're going to have is the neem is going to protect it for maybe about 5 to 7 days. And the Japanese beetles are active for almost 2 months, so you might have to spray a couple, three times. I would not suggest the grub control, because the problem with Japanese beetle is most of the time they're flying in from down the road and are not related to any grubs in your lawn. And the only reason that it's appropriate to treat your lawn for grubs is if the grubs are there. And my guess, my lawn, we've had Japanese beetles in Madison for well over 20 years. Now, the one good thing I can tell you is their numbers are way down. They're down 5% of what they were in their peak, and that may be where you are in Platteville, is you're just getting the first part of the wave. But my Japanese beetles come from a golf course two blocks away. And so, as I said, in all the problems, when there wasn't a birch tree in our neighborhood or a linden tree that wasn't almost totally defoliated back in the early 2000s, but yet none of our lawns had enough grubs in there to justify treatment. So unless you find things like 5 to 10 grubs per square foot, and I don't think you're going to, if you can take the grub control back, I would. And again, if you're going to try to protect it, the neem oil is a good choice. If you can get it on the tree, big trees are, of course, are difficult.
Yeah.
And as I said, I would shoot maybe around the 4th of July and then maybe consider about 2 weeks later spraying it again. And then let's see what happens. It just kind of depends on numbers a little bit.
Nancy, thank you for calling. Lee in Green Bay, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, good morning. I just wanted to ask Phil if he has heard of, I got a card in the mail about 2 weeks ago called, you know, this was an advertisement, Mosquito Squad. Mm-hmm. We will spray your property for wood ticks and mosquitoes every 14 to 21 days. Kind of a scam, isn't it? Don't we have enough poisons in the environment?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a couple things I sort through with this type of thing. In years that get very wet and we get the mosquito populations rolling, I don't care what you do, you're not going to be able to go in your backyard. I mean, that's just the norm because our mosquitoes migrate in. The other thing is using pesticides repeatedly in lawns, we can prove causes other outbreaks because you upset the balance and you get spider mites on things and the like. And so I'm all in favor. You're going to have a family get together. You're going to have an outdoor wedding. If somebody comes and sprays to knock down the mosquitoes, that's fine. But that's where it's appropriate. And as I said, it's just because of the dynamics. There are other kinds of mosquitoes in other parts of the country that probably lend themselves more easily to be controlled. But our floodwater mosquitoes, they said, you can't get at the heart of it. And repeatedly putting pesticides on to prevent a problem you're really not solving, to me, is not the direction that I would recommend to go.
Yeah. There you go, Lee. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest, number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. I'd love to hear from you. Tent caterpillars, I think they may have come up in one of the earlier calls. I can't remember now. But what about tent caterpillars? That's something that always seems to bother people when they see.
Really more of a cosmetic problem. I mean, if you let them do the things, you see this a lot with wild cherry and plums out in the fence rows. They get 100% stripped, and they'll leaf out again and do just fine. But if you're going to do something, if it's a plant in your front yard, a crab apple or whatnot, one of the susceptible flowering fruit trees, because that's what they like, now's the time to inspect, because the egg masses have just hatched. The tents are quite small. You can often either prune them out or hand destroy them. Much easier to deal with rather than waiting 2.5-3 weeks from now when the worms are 2 inches, they're done feeding and the like. So they said you can pretty much time just about the time the leaves are starting to flush is when the eggs hatch. And again, you're looking for something the size of a quarter.
Right.
You know, they're not very big when they first start out. I'm not sure where they're going to go this year. It's always kind of a wait and see, you know, depending on other things. You know, another critter that I'm watching a little bit, gypsy moth has been generally building the last couple of years it's now called spongy moth, in the state because of the dry springs. They are normally kept in check because of a fungus disease. We need a lot of moisture in the spring, and we're not getting there. And again, you get repeated dry springs allows the spongy moth to take off. And of course, that's a problem on oak trees, among other things. So that's one to watch. We'll see within the next 10 days to 2 weeks where this is going to go. For more than one reason, I'm praying for a little bit more rain, because I said that will promote the fungus, which is a great natural control under the right conditions.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. Tyler Dinner, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects today with our guest, Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. Great to have him back. And again, you can join us 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Bayfield County. Bill, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, thanks for taking my call. Okay, I spend my life outdoors, and I live for the outdoors, hunting, fishing, and whatnot, and I've never been scared in the woods before. I'm starting to get a little bit more scared of a certain critter, not big. It's called a Lone Star Tick.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering about reports or confirmation of people getting affected by that tick and how far north that has gone.
Sure.
Because I've heard of a couple cases in Bayfield County. And I was just wondering how far north and how prevalent it's becoming.
Sure. Okay. So in the scheme of things, I am more concerned about deer ticks and Lyme disease and a couple other diseases that spreads. Lone Star tick has caught our attention because, back now about 10 years ago, it was discovered that certain people who were bit by that tick developed a meat allergy, which is really quite scary.
Yeah.
When I was running the lab, once in a while we would intercept a Lone Star tick, including one. I had records for Bayfield County, but those were just records of adult ticks that were captured, and we think they were hitchhiking on birds in the spring, but there was no evidence of Lone Star tick breeding in the state until the last 10 years or so. And my colleague, Susan Paskowitz, Dr. Paskowitz, studies ticks and mosquitoes in the state. And she could prove that Lone Star ticks were not just being intercepted like I was doing in the lab, but were breeding in probably the southern third of the state. And this came out of some research she was doing with mice in deer ticks, among other things. I don't believe they're breathing in Bayfield County yet. It's going to be quite some time. The question, whether you're talking about the meat allergy or talking about Lyme disease, is because people travel, you can potentially get exposed and acquire it somewhere else. As I said, I would not be concerned other than take the precautions. I think we all should, for ticks, especially in the spring. If you spend a lot of time, there are treatments for clothing, do tick checks after night, after you've been out in the woods. I, unfortunately, on Sunday, came out of the shower and looked down, and down by my stomach, there was a little dark spot. I knew it wasn't a mold. I've been there before. It was a deer tick, and I had been in the woods, doing some stuff. And from what I could tell, the tick had been on my person for probably 24 to 36 hours. Probably not quite enough to contact Lyme, but enough that I contact my physician. And in those cases, they're prescribing an antibiotic, just one dose. But you got to catch it in the first 72 hours of the tick being on your person. And so I said, it's good to be careful with ticks. Lone Star tick, it's on the radar screen, but it's still infrequent enough. I don't think I would lose any sleep, especially up in Bayfield right now.
Thanks again for that call. Marilyn and Ellison Bay, we're on to you now. Hi, Marilyn.
Good morning. I have several rather large tamarack trees in my yard, and I've noticed the past few years, typically in June, I really get a heavy infestation of sawflies. Hmm. And I'm wondering, is there a way to prophylactically spray before they get there, or what might be the best process and what's the best to use? I've used insecticidal soap up till now.
Yeah, and I think that's a good option. Prophylactically, not really. In my experience, usually tamarack sawflies, you can get an outbreak for a year or two, but then they usually kind of come under natural control. So it is somewhat unusual to have a repeated attack. You know the timing. Soaps are very effective at something relatively thin skin like this. It's just a question of getting good coverage. And again, which is so typical, what happens with so many of these insects as they develop, they eat 2 to 3 times their body weight a day in food. And when they're small, you don't notice it. It's the last 3 or 4 days of their life cycle that things seem to disappear in front of your eyes, when you can argue most of the damage has been done. And so, as I said, if you've got some time frame, go out there, every 3 or 4 days, just kind of look to see if you see the first little worm starting. Cross our fingers, and as I said, maybe they're under natural control. You don't have to do anything, but the soaps are fine. There are other longer residual insecticides. There are other organic insecticides that also would be effective, but there's nothing wrong with the soap.
Thank you, Marilyn. Appreciate the call. Carla in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Carla.
Hi. Well, I'm calling about a gypsy moth, or I guess they're called spongy moth problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. So last year we had a really, really bad infestation. We have a small yard with six large oak trees, and we put up the burlap and pulled off hundreds and hundreds of caterpillars, but still, you know, and in the fall we took off egg masses that we could reach, but, you know, we could see still a lot of egg masses last fall up in the trees. And wondering if there's anything we can do this spring, if there's anything we can spray to try and catch it early.
Well, sure, you've got some options, and again, some of this is depending. Before I would spray the tree, I would have to be convinced the little critters are there and thriving. And, you know, everything is setting up for that. As I had mentioned earlier in the show, I'm hoping that things stay wet and the gypsy moths all get sick and die, but we'll wait and see. A very good organic product to use is this bacterial product that we call Bacillus thuringiensis. It's sold under Dipel, Thuricide, and I'm sure a number of other trade names. And it is a caterpillar-specific poison. It literally shuts down their gut tract and they die, whereas birds and other insects and whatnot are not affected. And the previous call that talked about the sawflies on her tamarack, even though they're little worms, they're not affected by this bacteria either. Mm. So you could spray it like any other thing and know that you're rather selective, but it only kills caterpillars. It doesn't kill the adults and the like. And so the timing would have to be right when you first start to notice. And then the question, of course, if these are big trees, the difficulty of getting somebody to spray them for you. As I said, I'm always have been pleasantly surprised in my career how gypsy moth has not gotten near as severe a problem as it was when I was a young entomologist and hearing about these horror stories out east.
Out east, yeah.
And again, a lot of this has to do with some natural controls, but the thing that sets us up is dry springs. And as I said, we've been going in that pattern. So we'll wait and see. There's also a virus disease that helps, but this fungus disease seems to be the most significant natural control under the right conditions.
There you go, Carla. Thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Mark in Lisbon now. Hi, Mark. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. One, I have some tiny little bug that is sticking its, I think it's proboscis or whatever, it's injecting and sucking out my asparagus stems. I have a little asparagus patch, and these bugs are also very tiny, maybe an eighth of an inch long. I was wondering if I could spray them with an insecticide. I'd rather lose the asparagus this year and get rid of those because they attacked them last year, and I got very little. And how many species of click beetles do we have in Wisconsin? They're a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm guessing on the click beetles, I would venture a minimum of 70, maybe 150. An interesting story, when I was running the lab, a Native American family came in and told me about a tradition that they had is that when they found a click beetle, if you looked down, you could find an arrowhead. And they wanted to know what a click beetle looked like for sure. And so we went up to the museum, and I didn't say anything. I just opened drawers and let them look, and be darned, they picked the click beetles. And so I've always been fascinated with that. I'm a little surprised on the asparagus. Typically in the spring, the biggest problem you have are asparagus beetles. And the adults, there's two different species, are orange with dots or stripes on the back, and their larvae are kind of dark grayish black. They get kind of humped, and they're more of a chewing insect. And they can just devastate. And they come out right away in the spring when the asparagus starts to go. I don't know if you've got aphids. I don't know if you've got some kind of odd seed bug that would be more of the sucking type of critter. I would consider those critters would be susceptible to insecticidal soap. And it's something you could spray on the asparagus. There's no harvest interval problems. So you should get the control and knockdown and not worry about not being able to harvest the crop as you go through. If that persists, I think this would be worthy bringing a specimen in the local extension office or sending it down to P.J. Leash, who runs a diagnostic lab now since I retired. And if you send it to the extension office, they can't identify it. They send it down to P.J. just to finally get this nailed down because they said, in the scheme of things, conceivably could be an aphid, conceivably it could be some kind of seed bug, but I'm not used to getting that many complaints this time of the year on asparagus, especially for the plants growing backwards, which, you know, makes sense if they're draining the strength out of the plant as they're feeding. But as I said, consider the soaps right now as a way. There are other garden insecticides. The only thing you got to pay attention to, there's asparagus is on the label, and there will be a harvest restriction. And for most things, it goes from 1 to 3 days that you cannot harvest and eat the crop. But if you're more comfortable, the soap, as I said, is definitely a solution, and you don't have to worry about harvest intervals.
Mark, good luck. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Kay in Rochester emailed to ask what treatments you recommend for iris borers. She did a good cleanup in the fall, wondering if they should be treated now. The leaves are about 6-8 inches long, and the early ones are just starting to bud.
If you observe the plants real close, it's interesting you see a real difference in different varieties of iris. Some of the Germans and bearded irises seem to be the most susceptible, and I've got some iris in the backyard that have never shown any signs. But the way the critter does, it lays its eggs on the plants, and so when you just get that excess plant material, you're removing eggs, so that's a very good control. When they first hatch, it literally looks like there is a small bruise or weeping on the leaves, and that's the little caterpillar starting to burrow in, and then they keep burrowing down, and of course, eventually get deep enough to really cause some damage. That's when you start to do the first treatments, is go out and look at it. When you see these little, you know, it might only be the, you know, a couple millimeters in size, but you can see, as I said, either a dark green spot or a weeping. And if you look close enough, you might even see the little worm, and that would be the time to spray. So we're getting pretty close in the scheme of things. And as I said, but the other thing to me has always been intriguing for how many irises out there is only a select few that seem to really have a problem.
Betty in Dodgeville, on to you now. Hi, Betty.
Hi. I keep calling about the tigers. How can I keep getting them every year, and is there anything new that we can try?
Not really. The various repellents and whatnot to put on your socks and lower pants. If you're wearing shorts, you're kind of giving them places to get to. And, you know, as the way chiggers go is they typically migrate on the clothing until they find a place of confinement, like the end of a sock or the belt line. And that's usually when they burrow in. And of course, the frustration is it's a day or two after they have burrowed into you that you start to get the irritation. I know some gardeners who religiously, after they work in an area that they have had chigger problems, is come in and take a brisk shower and do a real good job of toweling. And what you're doing is you're physically removing the critters before they're there. But as I said, what I tend to do is use the same sprays I use against ticks as a repellent if I'm spending a lot of time. And I have clothes dedicated to wandering around in the woods that have been sprayed with those repellents, and that seems to help.
Listener emailed, she'd like to know how to make mosquitoes not like her. She has heard taking B vitamins helps repel. It doesn't for her. Anything a person can eat that helps repel insects?
So you can find scientific articles that will talk about how some things help or some things hurt. Believe it or not, bananas, for some reason, attract more mosquitoes. But the bottom line is, although you can scientifically prove it makes a difference, it doesn't make enough of a difference to be acceptable for most of us. So if I tell you get 20% less mosquito bites, if there's lots of mosquitoes, you're still going to get bites. And so there's no all or perfect solution as far as food products and the like, unfortunately. It's interesting that the kind of repellents that are sold on the market now have really expanded in the last 20 years. There are a lot of natural products like eucalyptus oil and whatnot that have some repellency to them. They really do work quite well. The only difference with some of the natural products, they don't last on your skin as long. And, you know, some people are used to putting on some DEET and thinking and getting, 8-10 hours out of it. Some of these natural repellents, after an hour, they really need to be reapplied if you're going to go that direction. And as I said, as far as things you eat and whatnot, you will find things that make a difference, but to me, not enough of a difference to recommend it.
Tom in Luxembourg, your turn now. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I've got grubs in my lawn, and my neighbor this year started raising honeybees. I don't want to hurt the bees. Is there anything I can do to get rid of the grubs, or should I just let the critters continue to eat them for me?
Okay, so give me a little bit of background. Is your lawn getting torn up now with raccoons and skunks going after the grubs?
Raccoons, skunks, and turkeys.
Whoa.
Oh. It may be late enough. You know, one of the things that'd be worth checking out here is, in the scheme of things, there's basically two lawn grubs. There are the June beetle grubs, which tend to be very cyclic. They have a three-year life cycle, and, you know, you get an outbreak of them, then you don't see them again. Whereas Japanese beetles are on an annual cycle, and they tend to build. If it was the June beetle grubs, I'd say, you know, they're going to transform very quickly. It's not worth bothering. You got burned, unfortunately, but now it might make you feel better to treat, but it's not going to make a difference with the population. This one, I mean, you can look online or send specimens in whenever you're most comfortable with. The way we tell the difference on the species, grubs all look about the same. The Japanese beetles will be a little bit smaller. But if you look at the tail end of the critter, on our June beetle grubs, there's a series of spines that look like a zipper.
Hmm.
You know, a very well-defined zipper. Whereas on the Japanese beetle grubs, there's spines, but they're all random. There's no pattern to that. So that might help. For the Japanese beetle grub, there is a milky spore disease that can be applied. Would not affect the honeybees one bit. It poisons the gut tract. It would be appropriate. It's somewhat expensive compared to regular treatments, but would work. If it was June beetles, the milky spore disease doesn't work. And again, my comment would be, is they've already done the damage. The biggest thing is to repair the turf where the darn, you know, wildlife have caused the problems, and just go on from there. And typically the June beetles, as I said, it's a once in a lifetime experience for a lot of people. Is this the first time you've been burned with grub problems in your lawn?
Well, this is like the second year in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to spray or do anything that's going to hurt the bees or the butterflies.
Sure.
And the beneficial critters.
Yeah, well, I said the milky spore would be perfect if it's Japanese beetle. There is no such thing. There has been in the laboratory some bacterial products that would kill June beetle, but it's not enough of a market that I've ever seen it developed. And as I said, it's one of those things. I'm leaning towards it being June beetle, because with a 2 and 3 year life cycle, that means those populations have been there for a while, and that's why they would be hit 2 years in a row. So, as I said, it'd be worth investigating a little bit more to see if you've got an option. But also, again, it would tell you, is this going to be an annual occurrence, or is it just something that, unfortunately, they got the better of me now, but I won't have to worry about it in the future?
All right. And which one has the zipper?
The zipper is all the June beetles. And honestly, there's about 40 species of June beetles in the state of various
But they all
sorts.
Have that zipper.
They all have one form or another of a zipper. And then we count the number of spines and how they look to tell which one from the other. But that, you guys don't have to worry about that. So.
Okay. Tom, good luck. Thank you for calling. Marge in Waterloo. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I was just wondering, I was out yesterday and working in my flower beds, and it's above a brick wall, or not a brick wall, a stone wall, and all of a sudden I got into an area that was all these little tiny ants,
mm-hmm.
and they just crawled all over. I got bit a number of places and stuff, and you can't even work the ground without having them crawl up your arm and stuff. Is there anything you can do to eliminate that so that you can work to get the weeds out of the ground?
Sure. So, you know, I'm leaning towards their field ants. I'm not totally sure of that. But the thing with these ground nesting ants is you can get various things from the hardware store and sprinkle it on the surface, and the ants will stop being active for a little while, and then all of a sudden you come back 3 days later and they're active again. The secret to controlling ants that nest in the ground is to get the product deep enough to do some good. And so what I normally would recommend is, again, many of the garden insecticides and the like, mix it up like you normally would, but we drench it on. We soak it in. In fact, what I tend to do is use a broomstick or a wooden dowel or something and make 4 or 5 well-defined holes. And usually that ground that the ants have been in is very loose. They've worked it up, and so it's very soft. Make the holes, treat, and then you can honestly take soil and put it over the top so that we don't have any exposed insecticide on the surface, but yet the product is going deep enough. And, you know, some of these colonies can live for 10 to 12 years, you know, and so it's not like you can wait them out. So as they said, if they've been bothersome enough, I would use that drench treatment. You can just use a little bucket. You don't need anything for pressure. The main thing is to make those holes deep enough in there and then pour the product down the hole, and then I think you'll be more satisfied with the treatment.
Good luck, Marge. Thank you again for calling. And Karen in Madison, your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I have, my whole backyard has been the most abundant, wonderful June-bearing raspberry patch for as long as I can remember. And it has gone from a little, like, 10 square feet to the whole backyard over years. And it's been great until the last 2 years. And I don't know whether this is a bug problem, a disease problem, or both. But last year, pretty much, I had a great crop. And then this year, all of the canes that should be leafing out and flowering are dead. There's new ones coming up. That look healthy for now, but I think I might have some bugs. I think there's something called a cane borer.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I've had canes that look really, really healthy, and then all of a sudden they plop over.
Okay.
Any thoughts?
Yeah, you're going to have to do just a little bit more poking to figure out for sure. It definitely is the type of symptoms you expect, and there's more than one kind of cane borer. But what I normally would suggest is to take a pen knife or something and split the stems, because you should see sawdust-like residue. You might find the immature stage of an insect that's active there, and that would confirm it. And then, you know, there are treatments that are put on to prevent the eggs from being laid. But why I'm always a little cautious here is that in the scheme of things, I tend to see diseases to be more of an issue. And diseases also can cause great collapses. And here it's going to be more subtle. Of course, if you cut the stem, you're not going to see any critters or signs of insects feeding internally. But typically, if you look very carefully, you can see blemishes or discolorations. There's an anthracnose disease, which is one of the bigger problems in cane types of fruits. And so that would be the other thing. And of course, you know, the solution for treatment would be quite different. So I think I would dig a little bit more and do a little more investigating. If there's any question, you know, if it's a plant disease question, you can always bring a specimen into Madison, and Brian Huddleston in the plant disease lab can take a look and help verify it. But as I said, I think because the way the plants die is so similar, you have to do a little bit more digging to see if we can verify one or the other.
All right. Karen, good luck. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus professor at the UW-Madison, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, looking at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri. Great to have him back, and certainly if you want to join in, I hope you do. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Pat in Mazamani has a question. What's on your mind, Pat?
Yeah, I was just wondering, when Phil was talking about tent caterpillars and destroying those tent caterpillars, it occurred to me that maybe that was just the time of the year when birds were feeding their young, and maybe those tent caterpillars would be a good food source for birds. And I didn't think they had any harmful problems for trees either. I thought it was just cosmetic, but maybe you can let me know if I'm all off on that.
No, you're 100% right. In fact, I know bluebirds in particular are very fond of tent caterpillars as a food source, and caterpillars in general. Yeah, I, you know, that's why we don't worry about what goes out in the woods. It's basically the aesthetics of trees in people's front yards that are of biggest concern. You could argue in some cases they cause enough damage on an apple tree that it will cause less energy, and so the tree won't produce as well as it could without it. But that's an extreme case. And as I said, I think the problem with it's so visible. You can be driving down the highway at 60 miles an hour and see a tree that's infested. And there's not very many insects that do that. Gypsy moth is spongy moth. I still slow in making the transition. The reason that that one is considered more of a concern is that repeated defoliations of oak trees, they will leaf out again, but it really weakens them to a point that there are other problems, including the two-line chestnut borer, that will kill the tree. So that's why spongy moth is considered a much more serious potential problem, because it is life and death under the right circumstances for trees, whereas you just don't see that with either eastern tent caterpillar or forest tent caterpillar, which does not make the tents. That's more common up in the northern part of the state. It feeds on aspen, among other things. And although we have outbreaks every few years in places, they will come under natural control. And so we usually don't worry about those critters either.
Thank you, Pat. Appreciate it. Karen in Random Lake, thank you for calling.
Hi. I think I have a problem with codling moth on my apple trees, and wonder if there's anything I can do. I understand spray is not that effective.
Well, it becomes rather intense. You know, codling moths are the proverbial worm in the apple, if people want to think of it that way. And there are traps that you can buy that help you time when the females are laying the eggs, which then can be used when you use the sprays. And that's probably one of the biggest frustrations for people is, you know, you can't just use a calendar date with the way insects attack things. And you know, some things are years are ahead of schedule, below schedule. And that's what these pheromone traps do, is allow you to first see if you've got codling moths in the area, and then secondly, time your treatments. Unfortunately, you got to do a little bit of chasing to find these. You don't find them at the normal garden stores. But there are people that will sell you codling moth traps, among other things. The other place to get some information, the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture has a pest survey bulletin or information that comes out every Thursday. And what they do is give an update of what's going on. And they have both developmental models that tell you when insects like codling moth, these important ones, are active. But they also tell you what they're catching in their traps. So that would be another option, because they do report on regions. So if you go to the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture Pest Survey, and as I said, then I think you can sign up or see when it's on, because I know I get a notice every Thursday that the new information's up there, and then I can go and look at it. And that might help you get things timed a little bit better for codling moth and give you a little bit more of an option.
Thanks, Karen, for calling. Appreciate it. Pam in Green Bay, your turn now. Hi, Pam.
Good morning. My question is about wasps. Last year, some wasps set up a nest in an old, not used, like cable box that's attached to the house. And I got stung several times because it's right next to my favorite small planting place. So they're gone. This year, I thought, okay, I'm taking off that little device on the side of the house so they can't nest there. The queen showed up. I looked this up online, and the queen shows up first and was very confused, hung around for several days last week when it was really warm. As a matter of fact, she got into the house, the hallway. But now she seems to be gone. So I've been, and I'm wondering if it's because of the cold, or is she looking somewhere else for places to nest? And is there something that you can spray on to prevent a wasp from nesting before they do?
So the way these things get through the winter is with fertilized queens. And that's what you probably saw, was the queen that had spent the winter in the box or someplace close by. It's most typical that wasps do not go back to the same place to nest. We think this is a biological adaptation, because if there's a disease in the nest, you don't want to go back and pick it up. So you got to start from scratch. And that's what you probably saw, is her looking for some other kind of cavity to start a new nest in. So realizing that these are looking for pre-existing protected cavities, caulking, sealing, you know, whatever you can do to not let things get access to that is probably the best preventative. If something does start housekeeping and start building a nest, the earlier you treat it, the better. And you can go from there. Typically, we don't have wasp stinging problems until we get well into the end of July and later when the colony is finally big enough. And of course, they're the most defensive when the colony is disturbed. And then there are ways of treating. And what I've always suggested to people, if a wasp nest is visible, the sprays you can buy at the hardware store are great. If a wasp nest goes into something like this, if you treat it, a dust is a much more effective way of doing it. Because they have to come and go through that opening and they get the dust on their bodies and that what kills them. But I don't expect the critter to be back in the same spot. And as I said, I don't think I'd worry about it. She's either died or, you know, flown down the road and found some other cavity somewhere to start a colony. And as long as it's not in a place where you have to have a lot of activity, there's really nothing to worry about.
Pam, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Mary wondered, how can she get rid of ants under her sidewalks?
Boy, again, the thing about ants is what runs the show is the queen. She's the reproductive member of the colony. The ants you see are all sterile females. So you got to kill the queen. And there's only two ways to do it is, as I had mentioned earlier, to somehow get product down to where they are. And the difficulty in the sidewalk is, you know, unless you drill a hole, you're not going to get there. You can try if there's enough of an opening to pour product down in there. But as I said, it's going to take quite a bit, I would think. But it's worth a try. There are ant baits available, and they basically come in two forms. One for protein feeding ants and one for sugar feeding ants. And you have to pay attention to which they have. So you can put a little bit of honey out. You can put a little bit of cooking oil out and see which of the two the ants go to. There are some ants that only feed on insects and stuff. They don't care about bait, so we can't bait them. But if you find the right match, one of the most common toxicants in baits right now is boric acid. And as I said, so they either have a sugar base or a protein base. And you could try to poison the ants if they accept one of these baits. They take the boric acid back down to the colony and thereby kill the queen. That's a little bit more iffy in its effectiveness. It's great for ants inside the house if you're putting up the fight because you can knock them back. But ants on the sidewalk, which could be cornfield ants and the like, are a little bit more difficult to deal with. And as I said, what I would try to do is if you can some way noodle a way of getting the product down into where they're coming from, that is the best way to do it. Maybe you can pour something on. Maybe you can come from the side and you know, push a little hole in. I think that might be a little less effective. The trouble is where is the queen versus where you can get.
Yeah, for sure. Kathy in Viroqua emailed, she has an ongoing problem with shield-shaped gray bugs on her squash. She heard that a soil barrier might be effective, wondering if you could help with in that area. The garlic and onion spray was not effective.
Yeah, so these are immature squash bugs. The adult is a more of a brownish gray insect and is pretty hefty. It's, you know, probably about 3/4 of an inch in size, but they lay these golden colored spherical eggs and usually in clusters. And so when you see those, you know, they're coming. The one thing that does work because it is a soft bodied insect is this insecticidal soap we've talked about before.
Yeah.
And so if you're looking for something, when you see them, spraying with the soap should be quite effective. Because squash bugs overwinter as adults and fly onto the plants, I don't know of any barriers other than if you put a floating row cover over the plant. And I, for squash bugs, that's probably more bother than it's worth. As I said, I usually examine. If you found the egg mass, you could always tear that part of the leaf off and destroy it. That's one option. You know, we're a little early yet. Of course, the squash is too small. But boy, by mid-June is the time I would inspect the plants because that's when things start to get rolling.
Dawn wonders if there's a way to get rid of or discourage the gnats that swarm around her head when she's outdoors. They burrow into her hair, get behind her glasses to get into her eyes. They've been much worse the last 2 years.
So, you know, gnat is kind of a generic term for little critters that fly. Many of them are true flies. But the things that get in your hair, and I would even question it once in a while, you find a mysterious bite, sound like black flies.
Yeah.
You know, and black flies are notorious for swarming around the head. and can, if they are associated with moving water. So usually it's rivers, streams, creeks pretty close by. And they're usually somewhat seasonal, that you'll have a 2 or 3 week period of time that they're just terrible and then they seem to go away. Although, because we have multiple species, you can sometimes get a couple waves. Like up in Eau Claire, I know we get 2 waves of black flies off the Eau Claire River. There are repellents. There are head nets. You know, when things get bad enough, I put my head net on so I can work out in the garden and whatnot without being bothered. We don't have the problem really much in Madison, but out along Spring Green and whatnot, in Wisconsin River, it can really get rolling. Interesting enough, there are some black fly specific repellents. And one of them is a vanilla based oil. They sell under the name Bug Off and similar type of products. And I was amazed. I was at an archery tournament with some friends, and the flies were so bad we couldn't shoot. Somebody lent me one of the stuff, a couple sprays around the back, smelled very nice. Black flies went away.
There you go. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, and he's going to be with us right up until 12:30. We are going to take a look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Phil. The number to call in the meantime, and Ann and Menominee, stay with us. We'll get to you after the news. 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, looking at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. Our lines are filled right now, and lots of emails. We had a couple of emails. Jeff sent one of a dragonfly, beautiful, yellow, green, black.
Right. We have about 35, 40 species of dragonflies. I can't tell them exactly which one it is because I don't have one of my field guides with me. There is a Wisconsin dragonfly book that Carl and Dorothy Legler and Westover, I think, is the other author of it. I don't know if that's online, but I think that's what you're going to have to do, is kind of go through the pictures. And the distinctive thing are those two yellowish stripes on the side that will help you identify it. It's all the color patterns. And as I said, I'm familiar with 4 or 5 very common ones, but this is one of the more unique dragonflies, so it would be worth looking at. The other site you can go to, when I'm looking, there's a site called Bug Guide. In Bug Guide, if you don't know, it's just a bug, forget it, because there are millions of images. But if you know it's a dragonfly, you can start, and they will break you down into the families, and then you can go under the species, and people submit pictures. They'll also look at it, and that would be a place to get a species identification for you.
And Jackie emailed this photo of bugs in her kitchen area. They look like black rice with 6 legs and short antennas. You had a look at them, Phil.
Yeah. So it looks like one of the flower beetles. There's a number of insects that get in grain-based products. We can talk noodles, nut meats, and the like. And it takes some detective work. It's one of these things, because it's in food, you really can't spray. You got to go through everything. What's typically infested throughout, if boxes are not opened, you're still not sure. One of the options you have is throw it in the freezer for 4 or 5 days. It would kill anything that was there. But other things have to be put in containers that are insect-proof. So things like Tupperware and plastic containers to protect it. Because the biggest problem with these things, they're relatively long-lived insects, and they can sneak into another package. And so you keep chasing them around the kitchen. And it can be a problem in spices, too, since a lot of spices are plants-based.
Yeah.
So usually going through that kind of sanitation, throwing out what's infested, protecting the other things by either putting in the freezer or putting in containers that, if you miss something, it's contained. It can't escape into something else, and things will be fine.
Ann in Menominee has a question for you. Let's go to Ann. Hi, thanks for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Say, my call is about an insect that might kill spruce trees. About 2 years ago, I had a spruce tree down by my garden, and it's kind of an open field. So this spruce tree's at the top of a hill, and it looked great, and I was really happy it was doing well. And then a couple weeks later, it was all brown and dead, and all the needles fell off. Well, I have three other spruce trees down the hill from that, and one of them this year is not looking so good. It's got tons of brown needles, a lot of dead needles in the interior, which I know some of that's normal, but when I walk by it, there's like a whole cloud of gnats around it. Is there a type of insect that would be like that, that could kill spruce trees? Because I'm kind of concerned about it.
So the critters that I'm concerned about on spruce trees are usually various bark beetles. And although you could say they killed the tree, the interesting association is trees have to be very weakened for the bark beetles to attack. Healthy trees have defenses and prevent critters from doing that. And so it's always you take a step back. And the thing with conifers, of course, is by the time they show you brown needles, they've probably been dead for weeks, if not months. And so you're late to the game. And any tree that is stressed that much. And so to me, the question is what started this? Drought, when we have serious drought repeatedly in a couple, 3 years, that's a weakening factor. And we usually get big bark beetle outbreaks. But is it something else? Is it a collar rod? Is it, something else that's setting the tree up to weaken it? That would be my first concern, because as they said, healthy, happy spruce trees, I don't expect the insects to get the better of.
And thank you for calling. Peter in Racine, on to you. Hi, Peter.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you so much for the show. My question deals with ants. Been trying to get rid of them in the yard, under the sidewalk, under some pavements, along the house. And I also have small red or opaque ants underneath the lawn. Don't know if they're eating live grass or dead grass. Maybe they're beneficial. I don't know. Looking for a product that you might suggest to use to take care of the ants and not kill the other beneficial insects and bugs. I can take my answer off the air.
Sure. So typically I don't expect ants to kill grass, although the one exception, these field ants, which are relatively large ants, make these big mounds. You might see them sometimes when you burn a prairie and you see these little hills. Those are old field ant colonies. And they literally tear up so much dirt and whatnot, and they do not like their nest to be shaded. So they literally can put formic acid into the roots and kill them. We've even had them kill Christmas trees, believe it or not, in some circumstances. But the typical ant that is out in the lawn that makes the small, 2-inch size nests are cornfield ants, and they don't really bother anything. They mess with aphids and steal the honeydew and the like, but they really don't cause any problems other than, a nuisance. And they are a sweet feeding ant, so they sometimes come into the kitchen and create a little nuisance, but they're not an ant that lives indoors. Like we've talked about before, if I want to kill the ants, I have to kill the queen. And in order to kill the queen, if the nest is in the ground, I got to get in the ground. And so this may sound real tedious, but it's worth the effort. Is each nest has to be treated individually. There's nothing I can say that you can put on the surface that's going to solve the problem. And honestly, that's going to cause a lot more non-target effects. For the small ants, get a little wooden dowel, push it right down the opening that the ants are showing you, and then just pour a little bit of a pre-mixed garden insecticide, or you can find a lawn insecticide. And one of the things you can do in this case, again, is to limit the exposure of other things, is you can just kind of dust off the debris that the ants have put on the surface, treat it, and then use that to cover it so that you're basically capping, if you think of it that way. And the insecticides, most of the insecticides that we've got used in the garden are breaking down in a matter of days, and especially in the soil like that, you're not exposing much else to it. And so where people, come back to me and say, I've got a 3-acre lawn and I've got hundreds of ant nests, that's not practical, and I understand. But if they're in places with, on the sidewalk, like where you'd like to take care of them, to me, again, that's the secret, is to get the product down in there, and it usually helps to make some kind of holes with a screwdriver, whatever is appropriate, so that you can pour the product down in there.
Kurt in Mequon, let's go to you now. Hi, Kurt.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The reason why I'm calling is my wife and I and my daughter, we built this beautiful butterfly garden. We were in Door County hiking in the Peninsula State Park, and there by the ranger's office, they built this beautiful butterfly garden. So when we got home, we built this beautiful butterfly garden. and everything was it goes great until when the caterpillars are on there, we have wasps killing them all the time. So my daughter goes out there and counts them every day. Dad, we got 15 caterpillars. We're going to go. And then she'll go out there the next day. They're all gone. And she says the wasps are killing them. How can we try to prevent this? Can we stop it or slow it down?
The only way I know how to do that is to physically net the plants in one form or another so the wasp can't get access. You know, it's common in nature to have about a 95% mortality because of parasites and diseases and things like the wasps. And so if you're trying to promote it, you know, much like monarchs, people that are trying to raise monarchs, if you just let things naturally go, you tend to lose a lot of them. Whereas by the time you notice that you've got some larvae feeding, you know, whether it's black swallowtail or monarchs, as I said, you might consider making little cages that you can put over the plant. And physically protect them until the caterpillars can grow up. But I don't know any other way to stop them, unfortunately. And you know, sometimes, again, that's why I suggest to people when you get big larvae that are getting close to finishing, it's sometimes best to bring them to the house and even finish them off in the house to give you a chance that you can see what the adults look like rather than, again, because once the wasps find it, they can communicate. To some degree, not as much as honeybees, but to other wasps. But hey, there's a good eating over here. And so they continue to forage in the same area. And so things get worse, not better, when they find food.
Kurt, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Barry in Eau Claire, let's go to you now. Hi, Barry.
Well, hi. I have a broader question. Your guest has been watching critters for a very long time. And my burger friends say there's a bunch of species of birds that they're seeing now that they never used to see. Is he seeing an influx of what I'll call a migration of territory north over these last years? And if so, do they come along with no natural predators? And are we in for an infestation of what I'll call new bugs?
Okay. You're very astute. To be honest, I have a book that I have been writing for 8 years, and probably a third of it is of insects that appeared in the state during my career. And the biggest influx was southern insects that moved up into our area because of the climate. But most of these are native insects, and so their parasites and predators come along with it. Now, the other exception to that are things that are not native to North America that show up, and I got a whole big list of those things, too. In my experience with those is those problem critters are most problematic the first 8-10 years they get here, and then their parasites and predators show up and things get better. They don't go away completely. So there is a constant influx of new things. And as I said, there's well over 100 critters that showed up when I was running the diagnostic lab, and I'm sure there's things that showed up that we weren't aware of. Usually the ones only one that catch our attention are things that are doing things they're not supposed to do. Or if somebody's studying a particular biology of an insect and all of a sudden you find some other things that are associated with it. So, yeah, and the way I used to tease, and I've said this on the show numerous times, and probably go back 25, 30 years, is the governor moved us to Missouri and didn't tell us.
No.
Because that was what was happening, is insects that were in central Illinois when I started my career are now up into the Dells area. There's been that much migration. And it's, I think the lack of cold weather, really more than anything else, is, you know, you start getting 30 below and a lot of things can't survive that. We don't see that very often anymore.
Thanks, Barry. Appreciate it. EJ in Price County, on to you now. Hi.
Thanks, Phil, for all of your service. I'm wondering, is there a spray a homeowner can use to spray around the perimeter of the yard next to the woods to create a barrier for ticks? One time we used a commercial service, but we don't want to threaten pollinators. And so I have used permethrin. Does that work, or is there something better?
Permethrin works. It is a bit of an issue for pollinators, but I think it's a better selection than some of the other things that have been used historically. And one spray a year is sufficient. I mean, you don't have to repeat it spray. So again, you can target your sprays, and in where most of these have been done has been really quite early. You know, we're talking when things are, you know, ticks are active anything above 45 degrees. So you could even spray the end of April when there really isn't a lot of activity. The other thing I would suggest, you know, it's that margin where you mow and cut that barrier that you're treating, there shouldn't be a lot of things in flower in that spot at the time. And that's where you get the biggest exposure. If you've got things in flower and then you treat, then the pollinators have a chance of coming in contact with it. But treating, as I said, with something like permethrin, I think is very acceptable. And you don't have to treat a large area because most of our ticks have a two-year life cycle. That's the reason you don't have to put multiple sprays. You know, ticks don't move very far, and so you kind of clean out what's there. The other thing is mowed lawns are not tick habitat.
Right.
You know, it's more the long grass and the shrubbery and stuff. And so those are the edges that you want to treat. And it's very appropriate to do it yourself, and it really isn't going to cost much as far as time or chemical.
Thank you for calling, EJ. Mark in Eau Claire, let's go to you now. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. Yeah, I am in Eau Claire, outside Eau Claire, and I have about 6 acres, and I have just out of nowhere, there will appear on top of the ground mounds of fluffy dirt, and I thought they were in ants, but I'm just not sure what they are, and they'll just appear everywhere, and they seem to appear overnight.
Be honest, they're probably ground nesting bees. In the spring, I see this quite commonly. In fact, I noticed my daughter's home have a big maple tree, and the sand is a little bit lighter, which you wouldn't. The ground soil is almost sandy, which you don't normally expect in Madison, and it looks like an ant nest, but the hole is much bigger, and you don't see ants coming in and out. And what those are some ground nesting solitary bees, meaning each one of those holes is only a single critter. They don't build a colony. Many of them are even stingless species, and predominantly many of these bees are spring active, and that's the only time you see them. And so I bet you that's what you see. What would be worth on a nice sunny day, just bring the lawn chair and maybe a glass of iced tea and just sit and watch. And what you should see is every once in a while, a critter will come in and go down in there. They're collecting pollen. They drop the pollen off. They lay an egg, and then they're done. And their grubs develop in the ground the rest of the season by themselves. And, you know, in the scheme of things with wasps and bees, if they live in colonies, they are quite aggressive because they have something to defend. Solitary bees like this
are not. Oh, Mark, there you go. Thank you so much. Mike in Milwaukee, on to you now. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. I was a few years ago taking a hike to a little nature center on the east side of Madison, and there was a soda pop can that I noticed. I was about to pick it up, and I could see that it was swarming with ants that were so tiny you could just barely make them out to be ants. Just curious if you might know what that was.
It could be. So the smallest ant that I'm used to seeing is something we call a thief ant. It's an ant that shows up in the kitchen. But the other name for it is grease ant because they like protein and in oily type things. So I wouldn't expect them to be interested in the kind of sugars you find in soda. The most common small ant I see associated with sugars is probably the cornfield ant, which is bigger than the thief ant. But there's still a couple other possibilities. But that would be my first guess. Cornfields, there's three or four different species in that group. Very common. And as I said, the interesting thing, we talked about them earlier, is they also are associated with aphids because they milk the sugar honeydew, the plant sap from the aphids, as one of their primary food sources. And I could see them utilizing soda if they could find it.
Karen emailed to ask if jumping worms can kill raspberry beds, I think, or raspberry plants.
Generally, I would say no. You know, jumping worms have been quite interesting. Unfortunately, we discovered them in our flower garden about 5 years ago. We have not seen any plant mortality, but they honestly disturb the soil and change its texture enough. My wife will tell you there's certain varieties of plants that don't thrive. But as far as associating with plant death, I normally wouldn't expect it.
Kathleen in Indianapolis, Indiana, emailed to ask if there's a non-toxic, non-deadly way to deal with paper wasps. So, you know, it's a beneficial insect and a pollinator. An all-black wasp is building a nest above her front door. where people all come and go, packages are delivered and so forth. And the nest is small now. It's only about the size of a quarter.
Yeah. The problem is almost anything you use. You know, I've had people that even use household cleaners to spray. But I mean, you can argue that they're toxic. I mean, if it kills a thing, it's toxic. So there are some, quote, home remedies that would be effective. The other thing is the physical side of trying to, if you can disturb the nest, because it's best to do it now when it's small before she starts getting workers and things get far more aggressive, is disturb the nest. If she starts coming back, you wonder if you can use some netting or other physical means to keep her off that area and let her go find some other place. Because I much agree with you. Normally, you try to suggest to people is to try to get some feel for how much people contact you'll have with a nest. And if it's up in a big tree somewhere, you say, don't bother. But it's right in front of your front door. You really have to deal with it because, as I said, they're only going to get more critters and they're easily disturbed when they're that close to a door, and we don't want people getting stung.
Molly emailed to ask how she can get rid of black iridescent beetles that take over her apple trees. I wonder if it's black and green.
Yeah, Japanese beetle would be the first. The question would be season time. Japanese beetles start showing up the last week of June and then on through July. And they do appear greeny metallic, so they're when you only see one, they look pretty. When you see 10,000 on your apple tree, they're not so pretty. They do respond to treatments. One of the early callers we had today was using neem oil, which is a natural product that has some effect against Japanese beetle. But as we mentioned, the frustration with that's going to be a little bit is that it only lasts for a few days, and you might have to apply more than once. But the other thing I found with Japanese beetle in my own yard when they were quite active a few years ago is if I could convince them to get off a plant by treating it, they often would find some other plant to pick on. And unfortunately, it was my neighbor's plant, but it made life easier on me. I had some potent till. I never saw the yellow flowers. They always ate flowers off it. So I went out and treated it, and they decided, and they do gang up on plants. That's probably the best way to put it, is when they start feeding, they attract other ones. It has something to do with leaf chemistry and things that are given off. And so one treatment early may just stop it for you, even though they will be around bothering other plants in the neighborhood. The other thing I would ask for, because if they're feeding on your apples, if there's any grapevines, wild or domestic, they love grapevines. They make these real lacy leaves on it. That would be the dead giveaway that what you've got is Japanese beetle.
Joyce in Menominee emailed, if she uses a hose to spray in between her metal box and the wood surrounding the box, will that drive the carpenter bees away without killing them?
Probably not. They'll find it a momentary inconvenience. carpenter bees are, this is one of the things that's becoming more of a problem because of the climate. And often you have to treat the individual whole and deal with it there. The other thing is that carpenter bees like softwood. And so sometimes replacing the wood is the way that you convince them to find somewhere else to go.
Phil, a pleasure. Thank you so much. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Sounds good.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. He'll be back. Well, that was a great show. Bill Volkert's back tomorrow to give us an update on spring migration, and we'll also play a few bird calls for you as well. That's from 11 to 12:30 tomorrow. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.